You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we'll talk to Aaron Collins, also known as the Mask Nerd, about all the masks he's tested and which ones are the best. Now, we got a lot of show pitches on Central Time. We got one recently that got us thinking. A pet insurance company called Trupanion surveyed its database to see what the most popular pet names were. If you're interested, the top dog names were Bella, Luna, and Charlie. For cats, the top names were Luna, Milo, and Oliver. Now, those were the top names from just one company. That got us wondering about your pets and their names and how you chose those names. You could join in right now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What's the name of your pet? A dog, cat, goldfish, gerbil, ferret? What's the story behind the name? You name after a favorite musician or other celebrity, someone special in your life? Or is this really personal to that pet? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. The name of your pet and the story behind said name. You can also email ideas@WPR.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. While you're calling in at 800-642-1234, we've heard from a bunch of people electronically. Billy emailed saying that naming dogs is usually a long process. Billy has three dogs and says, quoting here, "My bulldog slash beagle mix is named Lottie after my grandmother. Prior to her choosing to live with us, we had a Shih Tzu named Nelson after my grandfather, so it seemed like the perfect name. Many ways she fits the name and reminds me of my grandmother." And Sandra wrote, "Marlo came to us from a friend who was allergic to him. His name was Marlo, M-A-R-L-O. Sandra had no idea why, but figured that cats don't care about spellings. They change it to Marlo, M-A-R-L-O-W-E. Sounds the same. Sandra says he's creative. He could be named after Christmas, Christopher Marlowe, the English playwright. Since he's curious, he could be named before Philip Marlowe, the fictional detective. We love Marlo either way." Well, let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Christina starts us off in Pewaukee. Christina, hi.
Hi there. We have a very pampered pug whose name is Hercules Mulligan.
Hercules Mulligan.
Yeah. We're of the opinion that small dogs should have big names. So they don't have a complex. And Hercules Mulligan is a character in the musical Hamilton, who's actually based on a real-life figure by the same name. So it's also quite a heroic name.
And does Hercules have a heroic personality?
No, he's very silly. And we call him Hermy for short, and Hermy's probably a much better match.
That sounds about right. Thank you so much. I love it. Hermy, a.k.a. Hercules Mulligan. Christina, thanks for getting us started. Let's go to Mark next in Bloomer. Mark, hi.
So we got ourselves a new kitten, and we thought it was a girl, and we couldn't come up with a name. But now we found out it's a boy, and we don't have a name. And I'm hoping that somebody out there can help us find a good boy cat name that's, like, a good boy cat name. Because I don't have a name yet.
Oh, no.
I keep calling him Kitty.
Keep calling him Kitty. Yeah, you don't want to let that stick. Okay, listeners, you can help Mark name his boy kitty, TBD named right now. Good luck, Mark. Thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. Just saw a survey sort of thing of the most popular pet names, asking about what you named your pets and why. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Rebecca is with us now in Oconomowoc. Rebecca, hi.
Hi. Yeah, well, I just wanted to tell you a real quick story. When I was picking up my dog as a puppy and driving home, I got this sort of insight that he should be named Argus. I didn't know what it meant, and I thought, well, that's kind of a good name, and I looked it up when I got home, and it was actually a Greek name from Old Greek, the mythology.
Mm-hmm. Like, and the one with tons of 100 eyes, right? It was always watching,
right,
everything.
Exactly. A 100-eyed guardian, and when it was killed by Zeus, it became the peacock, and it means vigilant and bright, and it really fits this little guy. This is a little Scottish terrier.
Very watchful, even with just two eyes, right?
That's right.
Rebecca, thank you so much for sharing the story, the origin story of Argus. Let's go to John next in Marinette. John, hi.
How you doing?
Good. What's your pet name, John?
Well, I got this German Shepherd dog. He's 4 years old now, but when I went up to Escanaba, Michigan to pick him up, he fit in the palm of my hand, and he looked like a hairy little baked potato. So he ended up being named Tater.
Tater. Now I'm gonna guess. I'm just gonna guess he doesn't fit in your hand anymore, John.
No, he sure does. No, he can put his paws on my chest and give me a kiss on the face.
Awesome. Is he a couch potato or is he a pretty active shepherd, John?
Well, both. You know, he lives in the house, but he spends a lot of time outside. Baronet's a really tiny little town, and he's so good I can leave him, just open the door and leave him out, and he stays in the yard. Neighborhood kids, when they see him, they come running over to play with him. He's the best dog I ever had, best friend I got right now.
All right. Tater sounds like a great dog, John. Thank you so much. Taking your stories of the name of your pet, why you came up with it, how it got the name. And remember, we're still looking for a good kitten name. I should be asking everybody for that. All right. Carissa joins us now in Waukesha. Carissa, hi.
Hi.
What's your pet name story, Carissa?
Well, I adopted a tortoise, and my roommate came up with the name Tortellini.
Nice.
And I just got another tortoise, and I'm thinking I'm going to call her Ravioli.
Awesome. Now, tortoise, I once had a turtle, you know, and it had kind of a half water tag. This is a tortoise, though. You got a couple tortoises.
I do. I have two tortoises, and they have so much personality for a reptile. I get home from work and he comes running out to say hi, and he wants to, you know, me to let him out, and he crawls all over, and they're a lot faster than you might think they are.
Okay. Now, we're looking for a kitten name. Can you hit us with a kitten name, Carissa? You're pretty good with pasta themed names.
Well, you know, like fettuccine, I don't know, spaghetti.
All right. Fettuccine or spaghetti, the kitten. Those are the offers on the table. Taking your stories of the names of your pets, where you came up with them, at 800-642-1234. Helene is with us next in Lake Delton. Helene, hi.
Hi there, Rob. I've got a kitten name. I named my kitten. He showed up one night just out of nowhere, showed up after dark, feisty as could be. He was so little. He wasn't scared of the outdoor cats at all. And he was so tiny, I named him Kitten Little.
Kitten Little. I love it.
Kitten Little, and he grew.
Not little anymore.
And he grew. And when he got to be about 15, 16, 17 pounds, I couldn't keep a straight face when I went to the veterinarian. Said, I brought Kitten Little to see you. So I named him Normus.
Normus.
He is Normus. He's enormous. And he came from Normus's farm. He came from Normus's plate up by Pleasantville.
I love it.
Yes, and he's a true, I don't know what to say, honor. It's an honor to have a kitty named Normus, Sir Norman.
I love it. Thank you so much for that, Helene. We'll go next to Diane in Iron County. Diane, hi.
Hi. We got a dog up in Saxon, the northern part of Iron County. He was a Border Collie Blue Heeler from a farm, and so we named him Earl of Saxon.
I love it. And does he have a noble demeanor?
He did. He passed away
he
a while
okay.
ago.
I'm sorry about that.
Yeah. Oh, no problem. He was a great dog.
That's a
cool name.
Great name. I love it, Diane. Thank you so much. Earl of Saxon. Time for one more caller. Eric is with us in Rice Lake. Eric, hello.
Hey, I just want to give you a name of a German Shepherd I had. He was born with only one testicle. He was missing a testicle, and we named him Lefty.
Lefty, okay. I won't guess which one he was missing then, Eric. Thank you so much for sharing that story. Hopefully that's a fairly unique circumstance. I don't know. You can keep sharing your pet names and the story behind them. We got a lot of them on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Maybe we'll have to come back and share some of those later this week. Again, share them on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about the history of an iconic beverage.
What's the first drink you think of when you hear this sound? A Pepsi, a Miller Lite, or was it a Jolly Good Soda, a drink that has its roots right here in Wisconsin? A can of Jolly Good Soda is one of the many items included in the Wisconsin 101 Project, which tells the state's history through objects. WPR's Rachel Vasquez visited the Jolly Good plant to reintroduce us to a Midwestern favorite.
If you're having trouble remembering Jolly Good, maybe this will ring a bell. The next time you're in a food store buying cola, root beer, orange, or any flavored soda, take a good look at the price. I mean a really good look. At Jolly Good, we believe in quality, but we also believe in value. We want you to get your money's worth.
Jolly Good was beloved by Midwesterners in its heyday. Greer Foods started the brand in the 1970s in Belgium, Wisconsin, but after decades of filling fridges across the region, competition from the big soda companies edged them out. They sold the last case of Jolly Good in 2007. But then 2013 rolled around, and an uncle and his nephew had an idea.
The term craft became very popular in the beer industry. Was there some opportunity for us to play off that niche?
That's John Rassel, the nephew of the pair, and now the president of Greer Foods. His uncle, Bruce Greer, headed the company before him.
He was the one that really propelled Jolly Good to what it was.
The two talked about if they could relaunch the brand and how it would work. Soon enough, they had a shot at putting it back on store shelves.
So we just decided to make a small batch and see what happens.
Rassel says their first big win was getting Jolly Good into Piggly Wiggly. But before long, they were selling in retailers like Woodman's Markets, Sendix, and now their latest retail partner, Festival Foods.
Right now, I think we would deem it as a success.
Today, the company makes Jolly Good at their facility in the small community of Random Lake, about 20 miles outside of Sheboygan. They produce 8 regular flavors and 7 diet, including cherry, cream, and the beloved Sour Power. Before the cans get to you, each and every one goes through a special process. First, they mix it all up in a place they call the batch room.
So we have 2 8,000-gallon tanks and then 2 6,000-gallon tanks. So we batch the liquid back here, and then we send it out to the filler to be put into the cans.
Next, some tests to make sure it's all up to snuff, and then all of that soda and a bunch of empty cans are sent to the filler room, which always smells like whatever flavor is being filled. That machine goes very fast.
700 to 800 cans a minute.
From there, the cans are sent over to be boxed up and shrink-wrapped. And then they're put on a pallet in a warehouse with cans that go as far as you can see. That's where they wait before they head out to stores across Wisconsin, along with a few places in Illinois. Even with the pandemic, Rassel says Jolly Good has been doing well. But he says they've also got ground to make up with customers they missed when they had to stop selling.
If you do the math from 2007 to 2014, when we weren't on the shelves, we missed a generation.
Rassel says they have some help with that, though, from older generations who still know and love Jolly Good.
Part of it is that those older generations remembering the brand, remembering the memories, and wanting to recreate those memories with the younger generation. It's very impactful, this, you know, especially during this time.
That's where a lot of the brand's power comes from, the nostalgia people feel for it.
Whether it was camping, ball games, you know, the lake house, the beach, you know, you name it. Everyone, you know, just kind of reached out, you know, oh, I remember drinking Jolly Good.
Rassel's uncle Bruce passed away before he had a chance to see Jolly Good come to life again. He says it was important to pay homage to him and his work building Jolly Good.
Hopefully he'd be proud. I think we did a pretty good job.
WPR's Rachel Vasquez brought us that story on Jolly Good Soda. It's part of the Wisconsin 101 Project, which tells our state's history through objects. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, what's in a mask? An engineer who has tested about every mask on the market tells us what his data shows about which masks are the best. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Cloth masks have become a standard for being out and about during the pandemic. They're cheap and convenient. For a long time, they were the only thing available to most people. But now safer masks like the N95s and KN95s are widely available. So why aren't more people wearing them? Our next guest says it's time to ditch cloth masks altogether. Aaron Collins is a mechanical engineer with a background in aerosol science who decided to set up an at-home lab to test as many masks as he could online. He's known as the Mask Nerd. Aaron, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, once upon a time, Aaron, I think the attitude was the best mask to wear is the one you could actually get your hands on. You say it's time, though, to move on from cloth. Make the case.
Sure. I mean, I think cloth masks made sense at the beginning of the pandemic. we were really constrained about what was available to us. And really, cloth masks are definitely better than no mask at all. But the level of protection that cloth masks provide, really relative to the technology that we have in modern surgical masks or even KF or respirators, like KF94s, KN95s, and N95s, really just to me doesn't make sense anymore. And so when we talk about cloth masks, really it was about what we call source control, or what we often say was protecting others. But in inhalation protection, or when we breathe in, cloth masks really don't provide a ton, typically in anywhere from 30 to 65%, depending on the exact type of mask. And so the technology that we have is this material called Meltblown, and it's electrostatically charged. And so it like basically sucks particles too. It's really incredible technology. And it's really inexpensive and readily available now. And you'll find that commonly in those like blue square masks called surgical masks or procedure masks. And it's the first mask or the first level of mask to kind of feature that technology. But the problem with surgical masks is, while they have the technology, they kind of lack three things that we care about when we talk about masks. So we talk about masks, we talk about fit, we talk about filtration, and we talk about comfort. And so the surgical mask has the filtration. I would argue maybe not so much on the comfort side, because they suck to your mouth, but for surely in terms of fit, not great, right? They puff out on the sides and they leak through the eye, the nose wire, which kind of can feel blowing into your eyes. And so then you move to that kind of next level, and I call them protective masks or high filtration masks, but the technical term is a respirator. And those respirator standards you often hear are like KF94, KN95, N95. And when we talk about that same thing, so what's nice about these is they're specifically designed to fit to your face. So you're going to get like a really good seal to your face, preventing air from going around the mask, because really we want all that air to go through the mask. It also features really high-end filtration media. And so that filtration media means that you don't have to focus on like all of those things simultaneously. It's going to give you that protection. And so then what it comes down to is comfort, and one finding that fits your face well and is comfortable for you to wear, whether you like ear loops or headbands. And those masks, anywhere from like, you know, depends on exactly how well it fits your face, but kind of test data shows out between 85% to 99% protection, which is pretty incredible relative to that 30 to 50 with a cloth mask.
And can you talk about what led you to set up a testing lab in your bathroom?
That's a great question. About last fall, we didn't really have a lot of availability of N95s. So there was some alternatives like KN95 coming out of China and KF94 masks out of South Korea. And I kept kind of wondering, and my wife actually mentioned to it, I was kind of complaining that I couldn't figure out if they were real or not. And she kind of looked at me and said, well, can't you test them? It's kind of what you do. And I said, I guess I can. So I went off to create a lab and start testing lots of masks.
And how do you test those?
Yeah, so what's the technical term is a total inward leakage test. But basically, I use a high-tech scientific device called a condensation particle counter to measure particles as small as a few nanometers. I use that to measure the concentration of particles outside the mask. Then I put the mask on, and I measure the concentration inside the mask. And the difference between that is the as-worn filtration efficiency. And so I use like a sodium chloride test aerosol and a bunch of kind of high-tech stuff. But basically, it allows me to measure how effective a mask is right on my face.
Now, suppose we get one of those N95s or the other good ones you mentioned. How many times can we use it? When does it start to lose its maskiness?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I actually did some work earlier this year wearing masks and testing them. What I found from my work is that with 40 hours of total wear time, so like total amount of time on my face, in a typical indoor office environment, so not a construction site or something like that, but indoor office environment, 40 hours, and I didn't really have any measurable impact to the filtration efficiency. And with N95s, that's also the case. In fact, N95s are tested up to 200 milligrams of loading, which is a super science-y term. But that amount of material that would take to load that, if you wore that mask, let's say in Beijing, it's like a month of continuous wearing before you would even get close to hitting that number. So my data really matches the existing test standards as well. So the answer is, until it stops fitting you. Normally it's the headbands that stretch out, or mechanically it just kind of gets a little not as snug to your face. So 40 hours or when it doesn't fit really well, whichever happens first.
Oh, we've got a caller who's wondering about bigger randomized control tests on masks. Do you think we need more big research apart from Mask Nerd in his bathroom on these masks?
I would love to see government agencies really pick up this work. There are some other people that have been started testing, but yeah, I think in general, I want to see a lot more work in this as well as regulation, right? Right now, the N95 is good. KN95s, there are fakes out there, and that comes because there isn't really a regulatory body checking KN95s. KF94s, though, are good. They have the Korean FDA. They do basically a certification process similar to like NIOSH does with our N95. So I would love to see a lot more work in this space for sure.
You mentioned fakes, and I saw you quoted in an article, I think it was New York Times, on counterfeit masks. How do we know if the mask we're ordering online or buying in a store is counterfeit?
It's the million-dollar question, and part of the reason I started this work. In general, KN95 seem to suffer from it the most, and that's because the KN95 standard is just a standard. There's no government agency behind it testing or checking anyone's work. So in general, what my recommendation are is there are a ton of N95s and KN95s available from companies like Project N95. If you Google that, they have a whole clearinghouse of PPE, really great place to get it. N95s can be also purchased at large retailers, Home Depot, CVS. When you start talking online, that's where it comes into play. The Amazon KN95, I usually recommend avoiding it. There's been a lot of fakes that pop on there. Doesn't mean all are fake, but it's really hard to tell. As a consumer, I can show you two masks. They would look identical in your hands. One might test at 60%, one at 99%, and you could not tell the difference.
Should we double mask?
You know, I think if that's all you got, sure. But relative to what I'm talking about here, and most people kind of blow their mind, they think respirators is like these really heavy duty items. What I found from my testing is that double masking is considerably more difficult to breathe in than a good or moderate KF94 N95. In fact, even a cloth mask is actually harder to breathe in. That's what most people don't really understand, is that mid to high end of those masks are easier to breathe in than a cloth mask, a quote unquote good cloth mask, or a double mask situation. So in my opinion, just go for the good stuff.
It's a good place to leave it. Aaron, thanks a lot for sharing your research with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Aaron Collins, the self-proclaimed mask nerd. He talked to us about which masks are best, how to get a legit N95 mask and avoid counterfeits, and why he says it's time to be done with cloth. You can check out his data on masks on YouTube by searching Aaron Collins or the mask nerd. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, the Remain in Mexico policy is making a comeback, requiring Central American migrants to stay on the south side of the U.S.-Mexico border while applying for asylum. We'll find out why and what it means. That and more coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then the DNR backed off on a new proposal for curbing nitrate contamination in Wisconsin groundwater. We'll talk about how complex a problem it is and what other steps could be taken to tackle it. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we check in on the latest state assembly hearing over the investigation into the 2020 election in Wisconsin. First, the Wisconsin DNR recently halted an effort to set a new standard for allowable nitrates in groundwater. Nitrates are the most widespread water contaminant in the state, and the new rule would have targeted farmers spreading manure and fertilizer on their fields, taking a step to curb one of the largest sources of nitrates leaching into groundwater. We're going to talk more about the scope and complexity of the nitrates problem that affects not just Wisconsin, but several neighboring states, as well as water systems downstream. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a problem with nitrates in water in your community, in your well, if you have a well? If you're a farmer, is this something you've thought about? Have you made efforts to reduce runoff of things like manure and fertilizer from your farm? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. The state DNR declined a request to be part of this conversation and did not comment to WPR's Danielle Kading when she reported on the proposed rule being dropped last month. Ken Bradbury is director and state geologist with the Wisconsin Geological and Natural History Survey and the UW-Madison Division of Extension. Ken, welcome back to Central Time.
Glad to be here, Rob.
Can you give us some of the basics, first of all, on nitrates? How widespread is nitrate contamination in Wisconsin waterways?
Well, nitrate is, as you said, probably the most widespread contaminant in Wisconsin groundwater. It's produced, we think, mostly from agricultural practices, from nitrogen fertilizers, also disposal of manure from agricultural animals, and of course also from human septic systems and sludge spreading and some other sources. But it does have it's a pretty ubiquitous contaminant, and it does have some health impacts. There's a groundwater concentration rule of 10 parts per million nitrate as nitrogen, above which you are advised not to drink water, and that's exceeded in many private wells in the state. And so that's a concern. And nitrate is very mobile in groundwater, so it doesn't get filtered out by the soil very well at all. And then in surface water, of course, nitrate is a nutrient, and it leads to growth of algae and other things in surface water. And downstream, it all flows into the Mississippi River, down to the Gulf of Mexico, and it's causing dead zones and low oxygen levels in the Gulf of Mexico. So it's not only a Wisconsin problem, but a whole Midwest United States problem.
Now, for people in Wisconsin worried about the health impacts in particular, you mentioned wells. Is this mainly a problem, mainly a health concern for people finding nitrates in their well water?
Yes, we should all be concerned, but for the people on private wells in particular, it is a concern because it does have health impacts for people with small infants, people with compromised immune systems, and so forth. And the drinking water standard of 10 milligrams per liter or parts per million is, as I said, often exceeded in many, many wells. And so I'm not a medical doctor, so what I understand is it's not a big concern for most healthy adults, but for infants and small children and people with compromised immune systems, it is an issue.
You are a geologist, and I wanted to ask you some about the geology here. You mentioned nitrates travel pretty well through the soil. They don't get filtered out. I know certain pollutants, depending on your local geology and topography, they can be a lot worse in some places than others. Are there certain types of soil and landscapes that are bigger problems for nitrate runoff getting into groundwater?
Well, we think about vulnerability of the groundwater system, and that's places where there's permeable materials like fractured bedrock near the surface, or sandy materials such as you have in central Wisconsin. These materials, sand and gravel and fractured rock, allow groundwater to infiltrate very rapidly. Pass through with very little filtration. Areas less vulnerable would be places with a lot of clay in the soil or very thick deposits over bedrock. But those can be vulnerable too. But we focus mainly on areas of vulnerable geology like that, with permeable rock or soil or shallow depths to bedrock.
Talking about nitrate pollution in Wisconsin groundwater with Ken Bradbury with the Wisconsin Geological and Natural History Survey. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your experiences with nitrate in your own water or in trying to control nitrate runoff, possibly from your farm. That's 800-642-1234. So that brings us all, Ken, to the rule the DNR was working on when it came to trying to prevent that runoff from farms ending up creating this nitrate problem in groundwater. What was laid out in this rule?
Well, that rule identified areas of the landscape across Wisconsin that were vulnerable for a number of different reasons that are in the rule. And then there were different practices that the farmers would have to take at these lands. They were required to reduce nutrient inputs over many of these areas to certain levels that were thought to cause less harm to the groundwater system. I think the controversial part about that is it's obviously going to cost money for the farmers to do these different practices. And reducing nutrients is going to reduce crop yields, and that costs money too. So there are a lot of parts to this, but that's the gist of it. It was an attempt to reduce loading to the groundwater system and to the surface, and then to the groundwater system too.
Now the DNR has this on hold. It may have run afoul with something from the state legislature. That's a whole other conversation. That said, without this in place, do we already have any kind of restrictions on the flow of nitrates from the field to the groundwater?
Well, there are certain best management practices that are in place. Although I should say that the best management practices, and by that I refer to there's a different calculations that are made on how many how much fertilizer a crop needs, depending on the soil and the crop type and so forth. These are in place, but they are really designed to maximize yield of the crop. They weren't originally designed to protect the environment. And so we have these rules that are really kind of outdated now, and they're being used for a purpose they weren't really designed for. Beyond that, there really aren't a lot of restrictions on application of manure or fertilizers other than these economic constraints.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jeanette is with us in Warren, Illinois. Jeanette, hi.
Hi. I'd just like to let folks know I grew up on a dairy farm in northeastern Iowa, and we did a lot of strip cropping and a lot of crop rotation. But one of the things that isn't often mentioned is the huge amounts of unnecessary fertilizer people are putting on their lawns. And if you want to have a green lawn, it's actually greener if you let it get a little taller. And it's wonderful if you would plant natives and have those as buffer strips rather than having your ditches and things and your property boundaries mowed down to the shorter than golf courses. My husband's a beekeeper, and we have a lawn that includes Dutch clover, which keeps it green and fertile. We've never applied fertilizer. So that's not getting into the water. So we have things that the bees like. Granted, those aren't natives, but they're not aggressive non-natives. And you can do a lot of different things just within small neighborhoods and large cities.
Jeanette, thanks a lot for the call. Ken, I've heard concerns about phosphorus, I think, in lawn fertilizers. Is lawn fertilizer part of the story with nitrates as well?
Oh, sure. Of course it is. It's particularly in urban or suburban areas where people have a lot of lawns. In the big picture, though, the area of lawns is quite small compared to the area, for example, of cornfields. So in the big picture, it's probably not the big deal, but locally it can be, of course.
Jeanette, thanks for that call. We're talking to Ken Bradbury, director and state geologist with the Wisconsin Geological and Natural History Survey and the UW-Madison Division of Extension. We're looking at nitrate contamination in groundwater in Wisconsin and beyond after the DNR stopped moving forward with a new proposal for a rule related to spreading manure and fertilizer on farms. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions. What do you want to know about the use and necessity for fertilizers and how they relate to this nitrate pollution? Are nitrate pollutants a problem in your local groundwater, maybe in the well for your house or your local municipal water supply? If you are a farmer, have you taken steps to try to reduce the flow of nutrients from your farm into neighboring areas and into the groundwater ultimately? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with Ken Bradbury, director and state geologist with the Wisconsin Geological and Natural History Survey and the UW-Madison Division of Extension. We're talking about the problem of nitrate contamination in Wisconsin groundwater. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions, your concerns about nitrates at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Ken, if someone's concerned about nitrates in their local water, maybe in their own well, but they don't really know, like, what can they do to test? What can they do to watch out and make sure it's not a problem for them?
Well, that's a great question, Rob. I want to make it very clear to people that if you have your own well, and many rural people like me have their own well, nobody is paying attention to your well except you. And so it's really important that you have your well tested occasionally. We recommend once a year for things like bacteria and nitrate. And in most parts of the state, it's easy to get a test like that. Usually the county health department or your local village health department will know how to do that and where to take a sample. For instance, here in Dane County, the county health department will arrange for you to take a sample and have it analyzed.
When I was a kid in Michigan, we had our well tested. They said there's too many nitrates. Don't drink your water. We got one of those. We got a, you know, one of those water things where they dropped off the water. We drank out of that. I mean, is that the only solution for someone if they test high for nitrates?
Well, in some cases it may be. There are some filtration devices that may be applicable too. You need to understand how they work and what device might be most appropriate for your situation. In some cases, it may be possible to re-drill or modify the well, although that can be expensive. And it may be useful to try to figure out where the source is. If you're in the middle of an agricultural area, maybe it's a dispersed source and you can't really tell. But if there's a, you know, something right up gradient from your well, you might be able to change the local land use. But it can be a challenging problem, that's for sure.
Now, that's the local well. You mentioned this problem keeps going downstream, down the Mississippi into the Gulf of Mexico. What kind of effect do nitrates have in a body of water like the Gulf of Mexico?
Well, the nitrates, as I said, are a nutrient, and so they cause things like algae blooms, and those in turn end up using all the oxygen up that's in the water column, and having some bad chemical effects on the water that eventually affects life in the water body. So if you look at the Mississippi River drainage system, when you have all these agricultural areas in the upper Midwest, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa, all draining into this river, the Mississippi, that's eventually getting to the Gulf of Mexico. Now we see offshore of the Gulf of Mexico, these big dead zones in the Gulf of Mexico that really can be traced back to our Midwestern use of nutrients on the farmland. So it's a really interesting national problem.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Howard is with us in Trade Lake. Howard, hello.
Hello. Yeah, I'm up here in Burnett County in the town of Trade Lake. And we have an issue here that relates exactly to this. We have an outfit coming out of Iowa, and they want to build a hog CAFO in our township. And this hog CAFO will produce a 250,000 piglets a year and 9 million gallons of manure. And this is right along the Trade Lake River and along the Trade Lake lake system, which flows into the St. Croix River, which is a national scenic riverway. And as your guest has been speaking here about nitrates, the amount of nitrates flowing into the national scenic riverway will change the character of the river. And the kicker of this, a guy from SORP is trying to cite this thing, and he lied on the application. He does not have the authority to sign the application to the DNR for the WEDIS permit, and which is a discharge permit. And the DNR doesn't seem to care.
Howard, I don't want to get too much in the technicality of like permitting this thing, but Howard's point, a CAFO, a concentrated animal feeding operation, maybe coming into his community. We've talked mostly about plant crops with manure and fertilizer spread on them. Can do these large-scale livestock operations affect the nitrate picture here?
Well, they certainly can, and I don't know about this particular proposal, but. Mm-hmm. There has to be a plan for managing the waste from CAFO, any CAFO. That usually involves land spreading at some rate around it. And then there's also the potential of leakage from a lagoon or wherever they store the manure. So both those things are part of the approval process that DNR has. And I don't know the details of this one, so I can't comment on that. But certainly those are potential sources, yes.
Howard, thanks for the call. We're talking to Ken Bradbury with the Wisconsin Geological and Natural History Survey about nitrate pollution in Wisconsin groundwater and beyond. Ken, big picture, this was one solution the DNR offered, restricting some farming practices. What would you see as the key things that would need to be done to cut down on nitrates ending up in Wisconsin groundwater?
I'm glad you asked that, Rob, because even if this current plan had passed, it wouldn't have solved the problem. It would have helped a little, but it wouldn't have solved the problem. And that's because this is a huge dilemma for our state. We have this groundwater problem, and we have a standard that we're trying to meet, but we also have a very big and important agricultural industry that's kind of the foundation of our state's economy that has to operate too, and it has to be profitable. And those two things are kind of incompatible, really. And that's a very difficult problem that people in our state are wrestling with right now. So there is no single solution that's going to solve this problem.
That said, what are some of the individual separate solutions that would at least point us in the right direction?
Well, one thing that's probably a little controversial to say is that we need to maybe reduce our expectations for crop yields, which will allow us to use less nutrient fertilizers. And that can be a tough pill for people to swallow. Other things like planting cover crops and thinking a lot more about how we use our land are all useful here. But the bottom line is we may not be on a sustainable path with the way we're doing things right now. And then the final thing is pay attention, as I said before, pay attention to your well. Make sure that the other side of this besides the input is what you are actually drinking. And let's make sure that our wells are properly constructed and drilled so that people are getting good quality water out of them.
We heard from Julian Superior, who wonders if human waste contributes to the problem. And I think you mentioned septic systems as one possible contributor. Do we humans directly play a role here?
Well, sure, of course. The human waste does contain nitrogen and other things, and that contributes to the problem as well. Although when you look at the scale, the difference in scale, just in terms of, say, animal units, it's not nearly as big as the agricultural component, but it is a component, and I don't mean to minimize it.
In our last couple of minutes, we've got time for one more caller. Marcus is with us in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hi. So there's a farmer, his name's Mark Shepherd. He's in Wisconsin. He's been going around the world advocating a new method of farming, basically, which is returning to the old method of having smaller farms, kind of doing like what they do in France, building hedgerows and berms to keep water on the properties, creating retention ponds so that the water that falls just doesn't all run downstream and then end up creating flooding issues in Iowa and, you know, everywhere else downstream. And it's really a way to, they've discovered that it's used less pesticides. And so you don't need glyphosate and whatever else for ripening fruits, and you get a different variety and different mix. And so
I gotcha. Marcus, don't have much time left. I want to jump in. I have heard Mark Shepherd on the Larry Mueller show. Ken, are there different models of agriculture we could look at in our last minute that might have less of that runoff?
Well, sure. I mean, I think that's a great thing to look at. But again, as I said before, that requires a kind of a cultural change, and those things are difficult.
Thanks for that call. Marcus and Ken, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks a lot. You're glad to do it, Rob.
That's Ken Bradbury, director and state geologist with the Wisconsin Geological and Natural History Survey and the UW-Madison Division of Extension. We talked to him today about nitrate contamination in Wisconsin water after the DNR dropped its latest effort to move forward with a new rule about spreading manure on vulnerable soil. Coming up after the news, we explore the latest from the Republican-backed investigation of the 2020 election here in Wisconsin. And we have an ongoing conversation that we'll get to also today. New survey of some of the most common pet names out there. We want to hear your pet's name and where you get your pet names from. You can tell us about it over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@wpr.org. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.